I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact.
I was born again on the streets of Ferguson. I got saved, as we would say in evangelical parlance, by some kids with gold teeth and tattoos and sagging pants.
That's Reverend Osagyefo Uhuru-Sekou. You may have seen his face in media coverage of protests in Ferguson, Missouri. He's up late every night, in the streets, and thinking about strategy to change a system that's stacked against Black Americans. Civil rights veteran David Hartso has some ideas for Reverend Sekou based on his years as a practitioner of nonviolent civil disobedience.
The police and the military and the powers that be like violence. So why pick the place that they're the strongest, you know, in terms of how we're going to do the struggle?
In December 2010, Hartso and Sekou met in New York City to talk about the civil rights movements of the 1960s and today. The conversation was sponsored by Waging Nonviolence and the Fellowship of Reconciliation and moderated by Nathan Schneider.
My name is Nathan Schneider, and I'm an editor at Waging Nonviolence.
Woo! All right.
Yeah. So I want to start by asking David, when you see these struggles erupting around the country now, what stories are you coming back to? What are you thinking of from your past and the work that you've done? You know, what's been coming to mind?
Well, thank you, Nathan. And it's a pleasure to be on this panel with Reverend Sekou.
Bless you, dear brother.
And thanks, everyone, for coming. When I was just 15 years old, I had a chance to go to Montgomery, Alabama during the Montgomery bus boycott, and met Martin Luther King and met the people of Montgomery who had decided that they'd had enough of segregation. They were not going to cooperate with it anymore. And they were not going to ride the segregated buses. And even if they had to get up an hour earlier to walk to work, they weren't going to ride those buses. And even when a Black church was bombed, they didn't give up on their struggle. And they refused to hate the white people that had done this to them, but said, we're going to continue until we've integrated the buses in Montgomery, and we can ride it, the buses, in dignity. Well, inspired by that experience in Montgomery, Alabama, I decided to go to Howard University, which was a largely African-American university. We spent most of our weekends in jail my sophomore year trying to integrate the restaurants in Maryland. Well, for whatever reason, the owner of this people's drugstore decided not to give us any food, that he also wasn't going to have us arrested. So we sat there on the lunch counter to stools for 2 days waiting for something to eat. And it was the most challenging 2 days of my life. People spat at us in the face. People put lit cigarettes down our shirts. People punched us in the stomach so hard we would fall on the floor. The American Nazi Party came with their swastikas. And each time we tried to respond in a nonviolent, loving way. And toward the end of the second day, a guy came up from behind me and says, if you don't get out of the store in 2 seconds, I'm going to stab this through your heart. And I had two seconds to decide, do I really believe in nonviolence, or how else should I try to relate to this guy? But we'd had a lot of practice, and I just looked him in the eyes, and I said, a friend, do what you believe is right, but I'll still try to love you. And amazingly, his face that was contorted with hatred, his jaw began to drop, and his hand with the switchblade began to fall, and he left the store. Well, we then did something maybe even more challenging. There were 500 people with rocks threatening violence with us to us outside. And We had written a statement appealing to the religious and community leaders of Arlington to use their influence to get the eating facilities open to everyone. And then this was the hard part. We said, if nothing changes, we'll be back in a week. And some friendly media people got us out alive, and we went back to Howard and literally shook for 6 days whether we had the courage to go back and do it again. And on the sixth day, we got a call that the religious and community leaders of Arlington had met and had talked with the owners of the drugstores and the eating facilities, and had gotten a commitment that eating facilities would be open to everyone within 10 days. So I like to think this was the most important lesson of my life. When faced with something horrendous, such as segregation of the lunch counters, such as, you know, violence, war, injustice, we don't have to just take that lying down or curse the television set or the president or the segregation system. We can find some other people that care about that as deeply as we do, get some training in nonviolence, and just challenge that injustice head on. And in 1960, students all over the South were a part of this movement. We were just a small group in Arlington, Virginia, that was doing this, but we felt the support and the solidarity of people over the country. And it seems to me like we're at that kind of a moment again, where white police are shooting with impunity young black men or killing them. And I have the belief, the deep down belief, that with the tens of thousands of people demonstrating against, you know, around this country, that this kind of insanity, this kind of inhumanity of to our fellow citizens has to stop. And I think if we can sustain that resistance and keep it nonviolent, even in the face of the police repression, that we could change this practice of police killing, you know, in a question of months, not years or decades.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Sekou, where do you see us now? What has happened in the last few months since August, and where are we now, and where do you see us going?
Well, I haven't gotten much sleep in the past 100 some odd days. Dear brother, I don't know where we are. I mean, I just to be honest, you know, I mean, I could give you some abstract philosophical critique of the way in which hegemony's knees are shaking and that poor people out of a subterranean context have risen and shaken the very foundation of the empire. That could be a kind of abstract philosophical assessment of it. But I don't know, man. All I know is that these young folks won't bow down. I mean, it's, I was saying earlier, they have this chant they do, we're young, we strong, we marching all night long. Now they start doing the chant about 2:30. And I'm like, we've been out here all night long. What do you mean? You know, but they won't bow down. And then and it's a different moment. You know, Tefpo, great rapper from Ferguson, often says that, you know, this ain't your mama's civil rights movement. So, and this particular movement pushes all the respectability politics buttons. It's queer, it's woman-led, it's young, it is profane, nonetheless holy. You know, they curse. They say, "F the police." All right, and people, you know, a lot of folks on the older generation is like, well, you know, that's not violent. The language is violent. That's violent language. What do we do? I mean, one of the phenomena that is so brilliant about this movement is here is a generation, you know, three generations away from the civil rights movement. No connection with the black church. They can't stand preachers. No connection to the historic black church. Limited access to the tradition of the civil rights movement, decrepit schoolings, civil society crumbling around them, and they're always under attack. And yet they have maintained the second longest protest movement in modern history. They are 120-some days in, second only to the Montgomery bus boycott, with nothing. Made a way out of no way. Right? And so, in terms of kind of us having some general assessment of where we are, I just know they won't stop. And I gotta figure out how I'm gonna get some sleep.
Yeah, well, this is a, you know, when you first sent me manuscript of this book, the first thing I thought was, well, that's a pretty long book, right? So when you talk about keeping it up and sustaining the movement, you know, you've been a sustaining movement for a long time. What does sustaining mean in a movement for you? What does that take?
Sustaining, the word for nonviolence in Portuguese is relentless persistence. And I think sustaining meaning we don't give up after the first day, week, month, year, 5 years.
Decade. Years! Lord have mercy.
I want you to get some sleep. And I do need sleep.
to stay
at the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if we look at any of the movements in history, whether it was, you know, women's suffrage, whether it was voting rights, whether it was labor rights, the 40-hour week, the anti-Vietnam War movement, all of these, it's taken sustained struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't give up just because the police, you know, attack us or arrest us. For sustained struggle, for me, one, we need a vision of where we want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we need some sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
We need some good strategy,
mm-hmm.
thinking about how we're going to get from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the commitment,
mm-hmm.
that we're not going to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what it takes. Mm-hmm. But a commitment, from my perspective,
mm-hmm.
of maintaining a nonviolent, mm-hmm. action, because I have seen, for instance, in Oakland,
mm-hmm.
In the Occupy movement, where we had a mass movement,
mm-hmm.
In the early days of Occupy, and after people smashed some windows,
mm-hmm.
The people with children, young children, a lot of older people, people that were just new to the movement,
mm-hmm.
they didn't keep coming.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to be successful, I think, mm-hmm. this has to be a mass movement.
Mm-hmm. One of the romantic narratives that we give around the civil rights movement, and you were there, so you can rescue me if I'm wrong, is that there was not violence, right? That the police were vicious in their violence, and that there were people who broke nonviolent discipline. And I think also, so what we've given, and oftentimes was translated out of the peace movement and out of kind of bourgeois civil rights narrative, is this kind of, this, you know, nice people marching, nice people and dress well, speaking well. And so one of the challenges is translating to a generation, right? So I've done a lot of, I did quite a few nonviolent civil disobedience training, Gretchen and I, in Ferguson, is that when we talked about militant nonviolent civil disobedience, not passive, but militant. Now, one of the challenges we face is that it turned some of the white clergy off, and they're mostly their members. They were like, it was too aggressive, you know. And we had quite a bit of pushback on the kind of militant approach, where it's a direct confrontation with the state to create the moral drama. That particular brand of nonviolence is more appealing to a younger generation. It's more appealing. Mm-hmm. And then, not that you're saying this, I want to caution against white anxiety being a guiding force for social movements in the U.S. I'm saying, as a parent, I don't want my kids out there if you're tearing up this either. But something more militant, more aggressive, right? It's young, it's black, it's rageful, right? Pushing all the triggers in the culture. I'm talking about kids, tatted up. And so what is the balance between trying to build a broad movement while not allowing white anxiety to guide us in our work? I mean, we have to think in Ferguson. They've been nonviolent 100 and, I think, is it 20 days now? With 100, been, we've only had violence twice, right? So, but part of the reality is that the only reason the world is paying attention is the violence. It's the only reason. So I'm not discounting an argument around nonviolence. I believe in it at bare minimum tactically, and principally it seems like it makes pretty good sense too, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to tease out what is the container of rage vis-a-vis a more militant form of nonviolence. So is it the locking of arms that Rutgers does? Is it shutting down highways, right? Is it disrupting businesses and confronting citizens? Because we all guilty. Every last one of us pays taxes into a morally bankrupt system. And so we all should be inconvenienced, right? But I'm trying to, I guess I'm trying to get from you, Brother David, because I need some help. I'm trying to get from you, what are the tactics? Like, you know, I know you laid out in front of train tracks and all that kind of crazy stuff. So tell me, I need some tactical help, dear brother.
One thing you said, it was the violence that got the attention.
Yeah.
I would say what's getting the attention right now mm-hmm. is the demonstrations in New York and all across this country. Mm. It's the masses of people saying we're not going to accept this. Mm-hmm. The people of Ferguson are not alone. Mm. And I think people are taking note of that. Mm-hmm. During the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. we were blockading trains carrying bombs to kill people in Vietnam.
With your body?
With our bodies.
My Lord.
And we were blocking ships during the Vietnam War and blocking trains carrying bombs to ships during the Central America wars.
Now, those are federal charges. Hmm? Are those federal charges?
Well, they threatened us with 20 years in prison for blocking the ships. But when we looked up at the crates of napalm and anti-personnel bombs, and then we saw the ship that was going to take them to Vietnam, we said, you know, if these bombs reach their destination, it's going to be worse than 20 years in prison. Mm. Luckily, they didn't put us in prison for 20 years. But in the first ship that we blocked was called the USS Nitro, which was taking bombs and munitions to Vietnam. As we were paddling our canoes to try to stay right in front of the ship, and they lifted anchor, we looked up on the bow of the ship, seven of the sailors jumped ship and began swimming toward our blockade to join us in blocking that ship. They were picked up by the Navy, put back in the brig of the ship. Mm-hmm. But word about what they did not only went all across the country; it went to the American military all around the world. Mm. They told us later that when their ship went through the Panama Canal, the other Navy ships had all heard about the resistance on the USS Nitro and gave them the fist of solidarity. Mm. And about that time or soon after, the resistance within the US military to carrying out immoral, illegal orders of burning villages began to really increase very significantly. Mm. So I believe our courage gave these seven sailors courage to do what they believed was right. And those seven sailors gave courage to thousands of other soldiers to listen to what their own heart and conscience was saying about this war. That's the kind of thing I think we can do.
So, Brother David, I wonder if the nation still has a conscience.
Well, I'm not sure about the nation, but I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. Yeah. America may have gone from adolescence to corruption without ever meeting maturity. But I am suspicious of the claim.
Of the claim?
Of the claim that we can get enough white folks in the street willing to put their lives on the line for angry black kids, for angry black children.
If you look at the tens of thousands of people that are demonstrating all across this country, mm-hmm. They're marching across the Brooklyn Bridge. Or, I mean, isn't that a bunch of people that were doing nothing, you know, several months ago?
You're listening to Making Contact. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to a conversation between Reverend Osagyefo Uhuru-Sekou and David Hartso.
I want to question their notion of success. If it is the creation of an equilibrium, a negative peace, a status quo in which people don't have access to health care, decent living wage, adequate schooling, due process under the law, right? So I want to interrogate that very notion of success. And in most of what we've seen in post-liberation movements, you know, the great Sekou Touré, my revolutionary namesake, says that the problem with the African Revolution is not the revolution, it's what we set up afterwards. And so when we look at South Africa, model constitution, whites still control the majority of the land. And that's what apartheid is. 13% of the people get 87% of the land, and 87% of the people get 13% of the land. If that is a model for, I mean, high levels of poverty, high levels of economic deprivation, right? You know, HIV numbers exploding, high level of public health issues. Model constitution, right? Right. This is something about the founding of the founders of nations. They show can put pretty words on paper. Right, but in turn, and so I want to interrogate this notion of what success looks like, because one of the ways in which people have made an argument against nonviolence is that if you look at the civil rights movement, these are primarily bourgeois reforms. Access to franchisement, access to public accommodations, right? I mean, voting is a big deal, but it kind of is not if you can't eat. Right. So in you know what I'm saying? So given the fact that we're talking about access to a reformist project in and of itself, is that success? Now, I'm saying I honor the fact that we sit here in a relatively integrated setting without the fear of arbitrary violence by virtue of the fact that this gathering is not illegal. So I'm not saying that that is not an important fact. But I want to interrogate what nonviolent success looks like. Does that vision that you're talking about include making some ideological claims?
Yes. And I believe that overthrowing dictators nonviolently is only the first step. Mm. I mean, I think even Gandhi in India, they threw out the British. But they didn't really finish that revolution. Mm. And I think Martin Luther King, when he organized the Poor People's Campaign at the end of his life, was pointing in the direction of really much more revolutionary change in this country, in which every person would have a right to really a full and decent life, not just the right to vote or the right to ride on the bus, et cetera. And that's part of the reason he was killed. I mean, as you know. So we need to continue that revolution that King envisioned. And he was saying, we're going to bring whatever, 1,000, however many people to Washington, D.C., and shut down Washington business as usual until we make this kind of transformation of our society. And I think that's what we still have to do. And I see that in the making today when you see these demonstrations all across the country in support of the people in Ferguson. And I think the other question I would ask in the terms of nonviolence, violence, I think that the police and the military and the powers that be like violence, you know? And in the 60s, they often instigated it. They had people that would infiltrate and...
Yeah, we got them now.
Yeah. But, so why pick the place that they are the strongest? You know, in terms of how we're going to do the struggle. I don't think they really know how to deal with nonviolent, sustained, courageous, militant nonviolent struggle. Mm-hmm. And that's the direction we've got to go.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
We can help make history, and then we can go on to the next phase of the movement.
If I could just make one request.
My request of you all in this room is that when this, because this protest doesn't look like the way you're used to it looking, I ask you to look deeper. I ask you to look deeper. Yes, it's profane and it's angry because we have betrayed our children. And so rather than beginning with the beginning a sentence or a conversation, but if they did it this way, take seriously the way they are doing it. Just take them seriously. Take their humanity seriously. I was born again on the streets of Ferguson. I got saved, as we would say in evangelical parlance, by some kids with gold teeth and tattoos and sagging pants. And so I'm asking you to look at their humanity. And so when the media starts that they're violent and whatever, remind them that they've been nonviolent for the vast majority of their protest, even after America betrayed them on every occasion. I ask that you keep track of their humanity, and they're just finding their way. They're just trying to make sense of it all. And then my other ask is that you put your body in the way. In the way. Now, let's be clear in this moment. Whiteness will not save you. They shot a white woman with a collar on. So they will shoot you. But you put your body in the way for them. Because these are your children, too. And right, and when you feel like you're losing your way and you don't understand why, I want you to think about your baby. Yours. Laying in the street for 4.5 hours. You looking at your baby. You can't touch your baby that's laying in the street. They got police dogs around your baby keeping you from getting to your baby who you brought into the world, laying in the street, bleeding out. They won't let paramedics get to your baby. And then you understand why these folks are so angry. And we should be celebrating the fact that there's not a riot every 28 hours in America. These people called black have been so disciplined. When America betrays them, they still refuse to shed her blood. We should be celebrating them and lifting them up. And the way you do that is the next time they shoot one down here, you show up. You don't say a word, you just show up. Because these are your children too. That is my ask of you on the behalf of the people of Ferguson.
Amen.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to We Are Many for use of the recording of this event, which took place on December 9th, 2014 in New York City. To learn more about Reverend Osagyefo Uhuru-Sekou and his work in Ferguson, or David Hartzell and his new book, Waging Peace, Global Adventures of a Lifelong Activist, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get our podcast, listen to past shows, or help support our work. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.